everyone. Thanks for tuning in to the Message Podcast of Friends Church. My name is Gregory, and I'm one of the team members here, and we're so glad that you're joining us. It's been really encouraging to hear stories from people all over the country and the world who are listening in. We really do hope that our messages are resonating with you. We also wanted to say a quick thank you to those who are contributing to Friends Church. All of the things that we're able to do is because of people who donate regularly. Even small, consistent gifts help a lot. If you haven't had a chance to give yet, I would encourage you to maybe think about doing that, especially if it's been beneficial in your journey. To do that, it's really easy. Just go to the website, friendschurch.ca, and click the Donate tab. Or better yet, download our Friends Church app and click on the Give tab. Thanks so much for tuning in, and enjoy this week's message.
It's good to see everyone here. Welcome back to the gym. I'm Jeff, and just great to have you here. We're kicking off this new Seven Deadly Sins series with lust this morning. Is that why we got to have so many faces in here? Just can't wait to hear what I'm going to say, I'm sure. We timed it right. The Taboo Sex Show is in town, so I don't know if we have tickets available. I don't know. Can everyone just breathe? And let's just enjoy this, all right? I was reading online this past week a story of a couple whose love life is in trouble. This is how she described it. She said, "I've been married for over 10 years. My husband and I, we get along well. We both love and take care of our children. He respects me and he loves me. He is a great partner. Still, I feel as if we are nothing more than best friends. Our marriage is an almost happy one, but it is, for the most part, passionless. We've talked about what's happening between us, but any changes we make last couple of weeks, then we're back to our old routines. He goes to work, I go to work, we come home, we feed the kids, we put them to bed, we put on the TV, he falls asleep within 20 minutes into the program. I go to bed, he goes to the guest room, and we repeat. I've felt so isolated and lonely for a few years now. Just like my life is on autopilot, and things are not, well, no, and things are good enough. But there's just no excitement." You know, this is a common story. It can happen to anyone. I mean, haven't we all witnessed a committed relationship grow cold like this? Two lovers who once couldn't keep their hands off each other now living like roommates. Every story is different, and the reasons for that are varied. Perhaps one couple faces a crisis or a prolonged season of stress. Maybe work schedules get crazy or a new baby arrives. Or one of them ends up traveling lots, or another one gets really busy with some other stuff. It doesn't really matter the reason. You just watch their public displays of affection dry up. Their tones of conversation turn businesslike. And any sign of sexual interest or activity seem almost non-existent. Maybe it was your parents you saw it in, or a couple in your extended family. Maybe it was some close friends of yours you watched it up front. Maybe it was you. Maybe it happened to you. I want to ask some questions. Why does good sex so often fade, even for couples who love each other as much as ever? And contrary to popular belief, why does good intimacy not guarantee good sex? Can we want what we already have? And why is the forbidden so erotic? What is it about transgression that makes desire so potent? Why does sex make babies, but babies so often spell erotic disaster in couples? When you love someone, how does that feel? When you desire someone, how is it different? These are questions that Esther Perel, a world-renowned psychotherapist, asked in a famous TED Talk that she gave. I thought they're phenomenal questions. She spent years researching why people have affairs, what it is that they're looking for, not getting from the relationships they're in. Her findings and her theories are provocative. They especially poke at and question some of the popular teaching and beliefs within our Western culture. Esther, she uses the word desire very carefully, but in a very positive way. Actually, she uses the word desire interchangeably with the word lust. Again, in a very positive way. You know, many relationship and sex experts warn that prolonged seasons with an absence or a suppression of lust, of sexual desire, intense sexual desire or longing, extended periods of time, prolonged periods of time where it's suppressed or it's denied or pushed away, can actually leave us exposed to all kinds of danger. Which I find really interesting in light of today's topic. Today we're beginning this new series focusing on what have been called the seven deadly sins, and I want to talk about lust. You see, lust is listed as one of the seven deadly sins. It's one of the behaviors that people have believed leads to all kinds of bad things in life. I'm just curious, how many here are familiar with what the seven deadly sins even are? How, like, just out of curiosity. Okay, a few Catholics in the room? I don't know, I'm just guessing. you're doing better than me, because honestly, I wasn't raised being taught about them. In fact, if you go looking in the Bible, type in seven deadly sins, where is it listed in the Bible? You won't find a passage that says, and the seven deadly sins are. You won't find that. It's kind of been... So I've been kind of researching, like, where did this even come from? And how did lust make it on? Okay, so anyways, I'm just going to, for those of you that already know this stuff, just, you can tune out. But in case you're curious, let me tell you what I found out. Since the beginning of time, it seems we humans, we've been acting immorally and selfishly. And in the process, we've been hurting ourselves and others. And perhaps for that reason, humanity has sought a universal system of do's and don'ts, kind of a way to kind of control people. Stop doing this harmful stuff. Obviously, the Ten Commandments played a very instrumental role in their early days, ancient Israel, the people of Israel. But it's like they wanted a new system, kind of an updated system, to steer people clear of the worst behaviors. But it's a challenge, isn't it? Like, the list has to be complex and inclusive enough to implicate a vast range of what they would call disgusting behaviors. But it had to be simple and memorable enough to be able to guilt people in from the well-off banker right down to the illiterate peasant. It had to be encompassing enough to ward people away, regardless of where they are, who they are, what they know about these destructive behaviors. Now, there was a couple runs at it, but by the 6th century, Pope Gregory the Great, he edited the list down to about 7 items. He ranked them in kind of an order of severity, all based to the degree in which they offended against love. So, from most serious to least, went pride, envy, anger, sloth, greed, gluttony, and lust. Some of you are going, oh, good. Lust wasn't that terrible. I mean, it was at the bottom of the list. But I'm not surprised even in the least, to be honest, what I know of early church history, that lust showed up on this list. Because this list was built during the era of our early church fathers, the pioneers of Christianity. When you read what they had to say about sexuality in their early writings, what they had to say about sexual desire, you can tell so many of them had a very conflicted relationship with sexuality. I've talked about this before, but it's worth repeating. Second century, Tertullian. Now, these are some of the people, the heavyweights that wrote about Christianity, that wrote a lot of the theology that has been embraced throughout, like, hundreds and hundreds of years. Second century, Tertullian said, I would prefer the extinction of humankind over the evils of sexual intercourse. In the fifth century, Jerome, when he had a sexual desire or thought, he adopted a practice of throwing himself into a thorn bush. It would overwhelm him with pain. This was his way of kind of training his brain to never allow any sexual thoughts to enter into his mind. I mean, wow. Even Martin Luther, the guy who catalyzed the Protestant Reformation, he was quoted as saying, intercourse is never without sin. Really? Mark Twain, no theologian. He's a famous American author. He's read up on these guys and what they had to say. He found it fascinating. He noted the bizarre anti-eroticism of early Christianity when he considered heaven. He said, man has imagined a heaven and has left entirely out of it the supremest of all his delights, the one ecstasy that stands first and foremost in the heart of every individual of his race, sexual intercourse. It's like you've imagined heaven and you said anything you want is going to be up in heaven. Oh, except sex. We're not doing that up there. He said, it's like the rescuer that finds someone who's been stranded in the scorching desert. They're dying of thirst. And he said, hey, what do you need? I'm going to give you anything, but you can't have water. That was his observation of what early Christianity was thinking about sex. Why were they so against it? Why did they see it as something so evil? What's mind-blowing to me, at least my take, is that it wasn't from passage in the Bible. Yes, there are passages that warn against unhealthy sexual practices. But there are also other passages, which we've talked about here, that are very sexual in nature, in a very positive way. We've talked before about the erotic literature of Song of Songs. I don't think it was the Bible that led them to all these conclusions. I know some people say, well, it might have been the hypersexualization of the Roman Empire and how crazy things had gotten, and this was kind of the pendulum swinging within early Christianity. Could have been. Some have pointed to the risky financial and social implications in the absence of DNA testing and pregnancy out of wedlock, saying, man, bad things happen. You go messing around, all of a sudden your inheritance is going to a whole other family over here. Or someone gets pregnant of wedlock. I mean, that's cause for all kinds of social outcast type behavior. Yeah, could have been. Personally, I think this anti-sex message was the result of some of the popular philosophies of their day, like Stoic philosophy of the early Greco-Roman culture, where nothing could be done for the sake of pleasure, or Persian Gnostic tradition, where we got Gnosticism. They believed that demons created the world. Demons created sex, even our bodies, that your soul is trapped within your body. The only way to free it is by denying your flesh. All those carnal, lusty desires. You gotta shake them off. They'll free your spirit. This was popular. This stuff swept through the early Christian churches. Within 3 centuries after Jesus walked the earth, these influences combined to seduce Christian thinkers into a rampant rejection of human sexuality and sexual pleasure. Sadly, so much of the religious response to sexuality has been shaped by this very old, deep disgust and fear of the human craving for sexual passion. So even today, in 2019, when literally for the first time in human history, we have the opportunity to think about sex in terms of pleasure, thanks to birth control. Like literally the last 50 or 60 years have been revolutionary. If you look back at all of human history, this becomes a thing about pleasure. But even in light of that, even despite that, so many, especially within religious circles, struggle to have honest and open conversations with our partners about our own sexual desires and passions and hang-ups and turn-offs. There's so much shame, fear, embarrassment. We struggle to talk about sex with our kids, both about their pleasures and the risks and the dangers that exist. Our conversation, it's like it's about 40 to 50, or maybe 1,500 years out of date. Who knows? So while we sit quiet, while we sit in shame and perhaps disappointment or passionless relationships, the internet entertainment industry continues to educate our kids in their own ways. And we live in the silence and the shame and troubled relationships. It's not everyone, but it's common. This morning, I don't want to spend another minute trying to correct or defend our human sexuality against some of the warped negativity and messaging of our ancestors. I don't. I'm tired of having to spend this last 10 minutes again and again and again in our community trying to defend that sex isn't a bad thing. Tired of it. In the words of the great theologian, George Michaels, sex is natural. Sex is good. Not everybody does it, but everybody should. If you get all serious on me and you want to come at me after the service, I'm ready, all right? I'm ready for that fight. Just warning you. Rather, I think this conversation, really, it needs to focus around how can we engage in this better? How can we do better in this world, in the sexual areas of our lives? I think a deep and rich sexuality should not only be antithetical, should not be antithetical to a healthy spirituality, but I think it should be almost go hand in hand. Spiritual couples can and should be experiencing not cold, not lifeless, passionless sex, but sizzling, fulfilling, and meaningful sex. That's what I believe. I think singles need a new template for sexuality other than the old religious template that tried to deny them of their sexuality. It says, oh yeah, by the way, you can't have any sexual desire. Like, this is just so warped. It's like, let's not talk about sex until like you're... Anyways, it's brutal. I think our children need to be invited into conversations that may begin awkward, but lead to healthy, safe, educated sexual practices that don't lead to shame, that don't lead to future dysfunction, but meaningful and lasting relationships in their lives. Don't we want this? Don't we want this for our kids? Well, maybe not at their age that they're at right now, but looking long-term, we want them to have healthy sex life, don't we? I know this is where people all get all bent out of shape. I've had people leave the church when I talked about this and that. I'm just like, no, let's not do that. This morning that I have left, the time that I have, I want to talk practically about something that I think could be instrumental in injecting more sexual passion into committed relationships. Now, I'm no expert. I'm not pretending to be some sex therapist. But there is something that we've been learning from the experts over the last little while that has explained some of the mystery. How it is that couples have maintained passionate sex lives over time. Things that they've learned, things that they practiced, that we just weren't taught. No one had this conversation with us. From a very high level, couples who do well on two things, or who do well focus on two things. Now, this is couples who last over the long term having this white hot, passionate sex life, committed relationship. They, number one, they build great friendships. This is what the experts tell us. They build great friendships, specifically in the area of trust. They're able to answer this question, are you there for me? That underlies this thing called trust. People who last a long haul keep the thing white hot. They build great friendship. And number two, they prioritize sex. Among all the responsibilities, among all the kids to raise perhaps, or the career demands, the friendship and family commitments, passionate couples, they make sex a non-negotiable priority. But just because you're super close, intimate friends, one part of this equation, just because you build this great friendship does not guarantee great sex. Emily Nagoski, she's a world-renowned sex researcher. She put it, you need to regularly plan the party and show up for it. Love that. Every now, are we okay with this? I'm gonna throw out some real practical stuff that I think has changed things for Kathy and I. I'll be honest with you. Nagoski would say there is often one person of the couple, this is just common, that is dragging their feet to the party. They're less excited. Why is that? Some have thought, man, I think my partner just has a low libido or something. And that might be. But it also might be that they have a different system of experiencing sexual desire. Now, this was news to me. Nagoski teaches that there is a difference between spontaneous and responsive desire. Two different kinds of kind of lust systems, arousal systems to get you kind of worked up, get you excited about what's going to happen. I will put the TED Talk and the name of her book in the notes. I would really highly encourage you to do your research on your own. But these two common healthy ways to experience sexual desire just make so much sense of everything I've seen and everything that I've experienced. First, let me talk about the spontaneous desire. This is when you experience sexual desire in anticipation of what lies ahead, sexual pleasure. Some of us experience lust very spontaneously. You don't need a lot of lead up or warning. Your partner can say something or do something or wear something, and it's like the light is on. It's like, hello, what are we thinking here? How many just would know someone perhaps that would be like that? Just out here. Okay. Not you, of course. So you experience sexual desire in anticipation of pleasure without warning. It's a completely healthy way to experience sexual desire. It's not usually the spontaneous ones who necessarily hold up the party, so to speak. The other type are those who experience responsive desire. When you experience responsive desire, this is when you experience a desire in response to sexual pleasure. It's only after you begin to feel pleasure that you begin to respond in a very positive way. There are others of us who experience what is called responsive desire. You don't feel the onset of sexual arousal spontaneously. It's only after you begin to feel some pleasure. As you respond to pleasure, that sexual desire and arousal begins to happen. Now, Nagoski would describe it like this. She says it's a lot like getting invited to a party. Your best friend says, I want you to come to the party. And you go, of course I want to come. I'm coming. Mark me down. I'll be there. It's only after time starts to slip away and that party, which is on Friday night, you all of a sudden now are Wednesday, Thursday. Now, for the person who experiences sexual desire in this responsive way, starts thinking about other things. Oh, geez, what am I going to wear at the party? And, oh man, I got to line up babysitting. And oh, it's been such a busy week. Traffic. How am I going to get home? I got an Uber? All these other things start flooding the mind of someone who experiences it responsively. And they can find themselves just about to go to the party and they're kind of regretting it. Going, oh, why did I say yes to this? Anyone happen to know maybe someone? And so anyways, but then you show up to the party and everything starts happening. You're going, hey, I am so glad I came to the party. This is great. This is how it works for people with responsive desire. It's like they get to it. All of a sudden, they start feeling pleasure, and now they are happy they are there. For someone who spontaneously experiences sexual desire, the responsive type of arousal system can be very confusing and very frustrating. You can't for the life of you understand why this other, your partner perhaps, isn't as excited about going to the party as you. Like, come on. And they're distracted. They're thinking about other stuff. It's like green lights. It's all clear. Hey, hey. And they're like, oh, just... I'm aroused. Why can't you be aroused right now? Why can't you be as excited about this? This is very common. Two people can be deeply in love with each other, have a great friendship. They can schedule, they can prioritize a time for sex. But as it approaches, one partner begins to struggle to get into it. To use the party metaphor, they get to the party. And then this person realizes, gosh, all they're serving is meat here and I'm vegetarian. Like, I can't. Or the music playing, man, I hate this 70s crap. Or I didn't know everyone was dressed up and I don't like what I'm wearing. Like, all these different things start flooding through their mind and they're just not excited about the party. There's a common practice in sex therapy. I found this fascinating, to get a couple together who's struggling. The therapist will have them stand facing each other and they'll say, and the therapist will say, now, I want you to stand as close facing each other, as close as you feel you need to be to feel comfortable. Well, one person is like standing right there, whereas the other person starts backing up, backing up, backing up, backing up. Nagoski would say that they can end up 20 feet apart. That's how much space one person feels they need to feel comfortable standing face to face with their partner. She explains, she says, that space is not empty. That space is filled with all kinds of little nicks and hurts, little resentments that have happened that now are kind of complicating this intimacy that they're wanting to connect over. She said that space, it's filled with all kinds of emotional wounds caused by weeks or months or more of, you're not listening to me. I don't know what's wrong with me, but your criticism isn't helping me. It's filled with, if you loved me, you would. Or, you're not there for me. All these difficult feelings, they're like a bunch of different pets that are all laying in your bed, getting in the way of that intimate moment. I don't know, Kathy and I, we have animals, and you know, just when it's like magic time, these animals all like are clawing at our door, just like, beat it, you. Sorry, too many details, Kathy, I'm sorry. These feelings and resentments and little things, like they're all there. For someone who experiences sexual desire responsively, stress, mood, trust, body image, These are not just peripheral factors that are, they are central to your ability to create and sustain a healthy and hot, passionate sex life. And the better you get at identifying these things and talking about that which might be getting in the way, keeping you from coming close, the better that you and your partner can show up to the party in a way that each of you needs. It's like you begin to escort the animals off the bed. That sounds so crazy, but it's weird how even for Kathy and I, we've had these conversations where we talk about something as simple as the stress at work that won't leave. And it just clouds, it just sits there. It's not that we don't want to engage, it's like there's other stuff there, and there's this intentional act of saying, let's put this over here right now. It's like, let's take that off the bed. It's getting in the way. Does this resonate for anyone in the room here? Or maybe for a person or a couple that you know might you might be able to help. The more, we had no language for this. It's only recently that we're beginning to realize the difference between spontaneous and responsive desire and how it works between a partnership. But it's stuff that we're watching again and again happen. We're going, oh, it's happening. Stress at work, body image, the threat of kids showing up or waking up, health issues. The list goes on. What do you know what your animals might be in your room that are getting in the way? Are you sympathetic to it? Are there comments, little biting comments that have been made that you hold resentment about? The more we understood what's standing in the way, and the more we can escort these things off, the responsive and the spontaneous can meet. They can show up to the party in meaningful ways. I don't know about you. This is the kind of stuff I want to be talking about. This is the kind of stuff that I think needs to come into the public arena, especially in religious circles where for so long it's been roped off and said, no, we don't talk about this stuff here. No, we need to talk about this. I don't know if you have any baggage or scar tissue that you need to deal with in your sexual life because of some warped messaging from your past. But if you do, I hope you will address it. I hope you'll seek out counsel. If you need someone to talk to, we can point you in the right direction, some great people. Maybe you don't have the kind of baggage. I know there's a lot of people here, you didn't grow up in church, and you're going, wow, am I ever thankful I didn't. This is crazy. Yeah. But perhaps you and your partner haven't exactly been the model of passionate sex either. Maybe one of you is struggling to show up to the party. Perhaps this morning you need to think deeply and talk about your sexual arousal systems. About the kinds of things that keep you from showing up, that get in the way. Man, I'm telling you, Kathy and I were out for a walk last night just talking this stuff through. Just, oh, so great. Even if you're not in a relationship this morning, chances are you've had enough experience to gauge which one of these perhaps you are. You can identify one of these arousal systems in you. Perhaps you've had experience in past relationships. You're going, oh, I wish I would have known more about this or understood how this works. Hopefully this will be helpful in articulating this with maybe a future partner or whatever. I just think my experience in church world has been, we're always supposed to just talk to the married couples over here. Let's just pull them away for a marriage retreat. No, enough of that. We're all sexual beings. We all need to be able to figure out how to express this in healthy and appropriate ways in our lives and how to think about it deeply. So I may have botched it up lots this morning, but I tell you, I'm not apologizing. I'm talking about anything that I'm learning that's going to help. And I hope future-wise we're going to just continue to bring this up. You know, I think we need our own kind of I got to be careful. I'm free willing here, but I was thinking that taboo sex show. I just think we need to have arenas where we can talk about this in healthier ways. Would you get that? Would you be all right with that? Okay. Tom, you're up next week. Maybe we can incorporate something in there. I don't know. No, actually, you're talking about Pride next week. I'm looking forward to that. May we not settle anymore for sexual dysfunction. May we learn how to experience sexually fulfilling lives. Find different ways, different topics, different learning. It's current. Bring it into the conversation. May the shame dissipate. May the fear and the embarrassment leave. And may what we experience behind closed doors be something that is so enriching and appropriate and healthy. I don't know about you, that's what I want. You know, Kathy and I, we've been married 29 years. Gonna be 29. I didn't sign up for this. To end our journey together, battle-worn, resentful, cold, no way. I signed up for a sizzling hot sex life. Huh? Hey? It's a weird thing that you're clapping at that, but I think we all want it. Let's have a great week. Time out. I'm going, all right, that's good. Enough is enough. All right. Have a great week, everyone. I hope you'll get into some lusty conversations this week. That's what I hope. Your dinner table, family dinner, be exciting. We'll see you next week. Tom is up with Pride. It's going to be good.